So I've been struggling with recently just what is consciousness? What feeds consciousness? What sustains it? What makes it? What powers it? And it made me think of sand grains. For example, you could feel the different sand grains in this along some of these edges. There are edges to it where you can feel individual grains that are glued to the rest of the mass. It's current brethren. But that sand grain was part of a bigger mass that rolled downhill, got smaller and smaller. Finally, it assembled into a collection of sand grains and was cemented, uplifted, and here it is. And it has fully arrived here with us in its full manifestation of what it is. And its conceivable and its inconceivable qualities. So, in looking at its intricate nature, at the intricacies of it, also brings us to vastness. And so, one vast aspect is today is February 1st. It's also 77 years ago that Koban Orogawa was born. And there might be a birthday cake today. I don't know if one was brought or not, but maybe. So in looking at consciousness, its definition is, from Webster's, is the quality or state of being aware, especially of something within oneself. The state or fact of being conscious of an external object, or state or fact. The state of being characterized by sensation, emotion, volition, and thought. It's also defined as mind, the totality of conscious states of an individual as contrasted with the unconscious. So, for me, I can imagine consciousness extending to sand grains. The arrangement of silicon dioxide in its molecular shape indicates that the silicon and the oxygen both have understanding of their when they combine, they form a shape that is unique and yet it is replicable. And so the silicon atoms somehow know how to fit into the picture. When a sand grain is rolling down a stream, it is affected by forces of gravity, the fluid properties, the frictional properties that occur as it's moving. And in a way, gravity and these other aspects of these processes are omniscient. And I would like a debate on this if you're inclined. But that a sand grain doesn't maybe know in that it has a memory other than its properties, innate properties, but it is definitely influenced by this gravity, which is inconceivable. I don't understand how gravity works. I mean, we understand how it works, that we have the Earth and things fall towards the center of the Earth. And yet there's an inconceivable aspect of it that I think is worth contemplating from time to time. So, I want to bring up a bit out of a little recounting of Dongshan's enlightenment experiences in The Transmission of Light, the book The Transmission of Light, where he asks about, he talks about the inanimate consciousness that is transmitted. And the quote is, "In all present activities, as long as the twin currents of profane and holy do not arise and vanish, this then is mystic consciousness that is not in the realm of being or not being, yet is fully perceptive and aware. It is just that it has no emotional consciousness or binding attachments. That is why the sixth founder, Wei Ning, said that the senses discerning objects is not this consciousness." Our senses discerning objects is a kind of consciousness, but what they're referring to is mystic consciousness, where the inanimate is teaching us. When Dongshan crossed a creek one time, he looked down and he saw his image and recognized his true nature and wrote this short piece, "Don't seek from others or you'll be estranged from yourself. I now go on alone. Everywhere I encounter it, it is now me. I am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with being as is." So I think our endeavor to be here is to awaken. And how do we understand being as is? And the instruction is neither holy nor unholy. when we hear of the inanimate, we usually think of material objects, fences, posts, roof tiles, pebbles. And Dongshan goes on to say, as long as your feelings and thoughts are not diluted and attached and your perception is not scattered here and there at random, then that mystic consciousness can be bright and unclouded, clearly aware. And the final message is discern minutely. Neither grasping nor non-grasping, favoring nor non-favoring, and it's just some of the discussions we've had in recent talks have focused on that maybe it comes before form. You know, form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, or volition, and then consciousness. So, to arrive at mystic consciousness requires not making the distinctions, the initial distinction between holy and unholy, good, bad, sweet, sour, it is before all of that. One thing that Koben Roshi talked about was trust. The deep trust that we have in our quiet presence . He says, to forget oneself is with knowledge to give up your human way of perceiving things and to give more room to see what is actually happening to your own self and to all other existences. When you forget your small self, the whole universe appears. When we talk about trusting, about believing in something, or faith in something, we tend to think about this with a flavor of religion or spiritual way. And yet, when you look into your daily activity, helping others, taking care of children or sick people, or working or making something for many, many days, you begin to understand what it means to have faith or trust. There is great power in it. The word power is probably not suitable, but the capacity to merge one's life force around or within others is what I am talking about. So that's what I have for today. Any comments? Yes, Andy.
Question. That last part of that Koben quote, the capacity to merge one's life force within or around others. Do you have any thoughts on that? Or feelings on that?
He's talking about that in terms of trust, just diving in with that full diving in with trusting your capacity, your whole being, which includes your senses and your abilities and your previous knowledge, just diving in with all of it without holding on to any of it and getting in the middle of it with a deep trust that's also fearless. That's what I think. What do you think?
That resonates to engage someone or something without, you know, getting caught up at the baggage claim necessarily, but like bringing your own baggage to it and all the attachments and the feelings and the ways we want to manipulate and constantly control our experience and project some kind of outcome that is desired, but be fully there and work with it. There seems to be, like, even if things seem like they're a mess, there's this fundamental sense of there's something that's good, even though there's chaos. And I feel that resting in that and being with it is kind of it's almost like a place to sit in, no matter what's happening. I don't know how that came out just now. I didn't really know. I'm exploring.
Yeah, and it's from what you're saying, it's without preconceived notions. It's not holding on to value judgments, and even though those may crop up, and oftentimes I think with the close examination we are privileged to do in this setting, we're able to see how we're scheming. Because when that crops up, then it derails that moment. It can, oh, I can get into this avenue. Yes, let's go there. And instead of it, just watching the dynamic unfold and be present and interactive with it, which takes a lot of fearlessness. And I guess fearlessness and deep trust are quite complementary. Yes, Francis.
If we remain unattached, life is much more simpler. Because if we're a witness to our surroundings and not part of it, then we can see more in magnitude as to what's going on without being attached to whatever it is. Because it's hard enough trying to go within ourselves and bring peace to ourselves. It's hard enough. And like what you said about being, when he was at the pond or the, and just he saw it open up to him. Which is true, because you kind of bring yourself back to your center of your being and not have even chaos or whatever it is, your stress, your thoughts of what's around you. It does become simpler, because then you see something much more stronger within yourself. And the hardest part is being conscious of not being attached. I think that's a lot of us are unconscious, because we get so caught up with everything that we become unconscious. It knocks us off our pedestal that we forget to go within ourselves. And that is to become unattached and find, and even there, love and compassion becomes the inner truth of that when it comes out even more so. That's a practice I find myself, you know, working on continuously on an ongoing basis, is a love and compassion and, you know, selfless service to others, that all of us challenge ourselves with that, because we attach ourselves to other things for our own motives. We have our own ulterior motives to what we do. And so therefore, my take on that one is be conscientious, not unconscious, be unattached, so you'll see bigger and better things around you, and it gives you more gratitude. It becomes more clear as to what your journey is here for the rest of your stay in this lifetime that you have. That's how you see it.
Mm-hmm. Can you be conscious and attached?
Well, that is what we are doing now, is being, well, conscious in the level of, again, the animate, being conscious where duality comes in, right? Then there is a consciousness where you see yourself as whole when you come more in. It's like different planes of consciousness that I experience, and the struggle with that consciousness that turns unconscious is the struggle, whereas the consciousness that comes in within yourself that brings you a bigger, opens you up more to what you're here for, that becomes the conscious that doesn't become the unconscious, is what I, that's how I see it.
So in a way, you're exploring the periphery of the unconscious. When you're that conscious, you're, it's like, you're able to see into the what's already here, but it's like hasn't been apparent.
Yeah, or that's what a lot of us struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Until we go within ourselves, and that's what I find in meditation, that brings us to that certain consciousness. Become unconscious. That's how I can, in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Lance?
Is it Dumshan that has the, there's another story you're calling about the wall tile expounding the Dharma? I think it is. It's kind of similar with this inanimate object. When he asked, does a wall tile expound the Dharma? And his teacher says, yes, it expounds the Dharma brilliantly and without let up.
Yeah.
That was the first conversation.
It was.
Yeah.
It
is. When he met his teacher.
And then he goes to another teacher
who
then tells him, you must hear it with your eyes. For a long time, I did sort of think, okay, it's the senses, that's how we take things in, and all this other talk about you transcend your senses, and that's not possible, that's all mystical gobbledygook. But I'm coming more now of the opinion that, you take things in even before the senses, and then... Well, when you pass the rock about, the title of this is Minute Discernment?
Yes.
And there was something else about the human being way of doing things or looking at things. I can't remember where the quote was.
Neither holy nor unholy.
Neither holy nor unholy,
but also about how human beings, someone else's human beings, how they, well, when you picked up the rock, you know, it became an object. I think that's what human beings, we turn the world into objects. This, that, the rock. And then we all looked at the rock. And you even, well, when I looked at it, it was kind of triangular and has all this fuzzy. And we related
it. Toupee.
And we were right. We're relating it to other objects that we know, right? And we creating this world of objects. We objectify.
Yeah.
That's how we take it. And then even when we look at ourselves and other people, we make them objects.
Mm-hmm.
But what are those things? You know, we make them a thing. And you talk about otherwise, silicon dioxide. You know, you can start crushing it until where it's not a rock anymore. It's lost actually being a rock to really like pick it apart that way. And it's all like very mysterious. When you go into the world of science, but when we're sitting here, that's not what we're doing, right? It's not that kind of minute discernment. We're actually for me, looking at some point, once I calm down enough, at that objectification process. You know, if I think of myself as an object and I look at it, I will go into the infinite regress that Cliff likes to point out. Who is the object looking at the object and so on infinitum. Which doesn't mean it's silly to do that, because it shows how puzzling this whole objectification process is. But if you don't, if you can sort of take that step and not do that human being, what the human, like, do birds do that? I was wondering, do birds, is there a world of objects we don't really know? They may just soar through the air and have a whole different way of integrating their world. And I do know that in sitting a lot and deeply, there are times where I'm not really in a world of objects, or I'm slipping in and out of it. And sometimes the objects, like Doug said, they come to you, the myriad arms. Sometimes the objects come to me in a very intimate way, where I feel this kinship. Would I say they're conscious? I don't know. The word almost, it has so many meanings.
So many, yeah.
But I wouldn't say they're not. Mm-hmm. There's a presence there that you can touch or feel or resonate with.
Because there's a relationship there.
Yes.
There's a... Yeah.
So the wall pile expounds the Dharma or that rock, and brilliantly.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, we can't once we start dissecting it.
We can't?
No, the dissection, it's a different way.
It's a different way. Isn't that part of the process, though?
No, I think Bodhidharma didn't know any doodly squat about atoms or electrons or silicon dioxide, but I think he was able to form very intimate, deep connection relationship with any rock that was put in front of him.
Sure.
You know, so I don't think it's a necessary thing. Not that it's not interesting or useful or good, but it's not the fundamental relationship that at least that's what I think I'm doing. One of the things, maybe the most fundamental thing in sitting activity.
So I'm proposing this to be a thought.
A thought.
Discerning a thought and intimately examining a thought, because that's what we basically do in our meditations too, is that very intricate tearing apart, finding out what the relationships are in that, and where that thought came from, what is connected to the tendencies or the schemes of approach that we have towards that thought and the relations that are there. And so, I mean, there's a whole array of things that come forward.
Well, I do that if I'm having like trouble with in some relationship or something or whatever, but not so much when I'm sitting. Then maybe the thoughts come, I may just let them come or go, or I might look at who's thinking the thought. You know, where does the thought come from? And who's behind it? But not that intricate of a. I will do that when I say this. I'm out in the world of trouble. I have to figure things out. I mean, that's an important activity.
You
see what?
So
and isn't that the thought creates our own experience? So whatever that thought is will give you the experience whether you like it or not. Right? I mean, your thought is going to create your experience.
Whether it will direct it.
It will.
Yeah, and influence you to a great...
Yeah,
sure.
And then, you know, the less your thoughts, the experience will be as big as you want it to be.
Because it won't be as narrow because it's not as defined.
Right.
And Dongshan, just to rephrase what you said, his poem, Hark. That's it.
We're done.
Just to rephrase. That was his kind of awakening gatha, what you read, and I've heard it rephrased kind of in a different way that helps me to understand it. When you are not it, in other words, when you are not the topic, you could say, then it, the world, is available to be you. When you are not it, then it is you. How did you read it there? How's it phrased?
It is now me. I now am not it.
Yeah. It's kind of reversing that same thing.
Yes.
Let's say something grabbed me. Bodhidharma, wasn't it, who talked to the emperor? The emperor was talking about this holy or unholy. What's holiness? And Bodhidharma's response was nothing holy, vast emptiness. That comes to mind. There's something from Milarepa that says, don't separate the emptiness and the substance or the appearances.
Can I say?
Yes. And then Todd. What's next?
I think it was first up, actually. He has been trying for a while. Please go.
He's a patient man.
I was curious about what you're saying about consciousness and then there's unconscious. And what has been happening for me for a while, a few days, is that I buried our family dog. And so is it still a dog there in the ground? When is it no longer a dog? And in the mystical consciousness, as you described, has it always been? So what happened to it's no longer here? Where did it go? Has it always been? So, Cliff is pointing out interdependence, right? That emptiness, it's all interconnected. Something else also, right? It's all interconnected, but it all kind of comes together somehow and we are alive. Sure. All kind of comes together as that tile, I guess, and it's all manifests this, but then moves away back into this, I suppose, this mystical consciousness. So I don't know if I actually have a question or anything, it just seems inexplicable to me. Mm-hmm. And part of as my position seems to be is when you try to explain inexplicable, then darts away. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's all fine and good to put it into scientific terms. Very impressive, by the way, Cliff. But when it comes down to it, it's like by doing that, it's an experience, and so the experience, something happens when you start to explain it. But I suppose it's about the same thing. It's all interconnected. So even explanation is fine.
Interconnected with it too.
Yeah. But there is something, it's a loss of this 15-year-old dog. There's a loss of a human being, especially when they leave, as we all think they leave. This, they're no longer like that. And that's inexplicable. I don't, it's difficult in a way.
Are the relationships the same? At the moment of death.
It's still a dog. It was a dog when it was alive. Is it? It's no longer. Is it a dog?
Are the relationships the same?
Right.
Marco?
The short version. But it's about gravity, you asked initially. So reflection is something that I often think about. And it's interesting because you pass this rock around. And I agree with what you said, that matter is the place where consciousness takes place. In a silicon dioxide, you have the information, the geometry that is collected there. That's where we are made of matter. That's where consciousness takes place and arises. But from a physical point of view, matter is where gravity takes place as well. And we don't know what gravity is scientifically. We have descriptions, but we don't have an understanding. But there is one interesting property that we know, that is something that is part of element of consciousness, which is time. So the time is the place where consciousness unfolds. And gravity can be described as the place where matter goes to minimize, or actually to maximize the way the relationships are experienced. In other words,
maximize?
To maximize, because matter, gravity is what moves matter into the place of minimum time. That's what it is. So
minimum time?
Ties. Yeah. So if you take something and you let it fall, it's falling down because that's a place where it will experience the longer time. So actually your feet are experiencing, time is shorter when your feet respect to your head.
Oh, I see.
Very tiny, but it's true. And so if you're into the space, time goes faster, on the earth is slower. So just think about that. So potentially matter, and so the place where consciousness goes, tends to the place where time disappears. And in emptiness, time goes to the maximum speed, so it's the other side of the spectrum. So there are two levels of infinites, but one is maximum speed, the other is no movement at all.
Which is the center of the Earth? That's what you're talking about?
No, the center of the Earth is just going slower. Basically, if all the mass of the universe will collapse in one point, the time would disappear.
Then there's Heisenberg.
And it's Heisenberg. But the tendency of that, so objects goes to the place where the time flows slower. And that's an effect of gravity, how you can describe that. And it's a consequence of matter, which is a place where consciousness goes. And I have no comments.
Well, it's time for us to go.
Into the consciousness of lunch?
Yes.
And get some matter.
Adjusting some matter.
Matter that really matters.
Increase our gravity.
Yeah.
It's a grave matter.